This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I say that every day, so casually, but this may be the year where we say, thanks so much for listening, National Security Apparatus, NSA, whoever else out there is listening, Google, get on the list, join the bandwagon. Edward Snowden's classified disclosures and subsequent revelations about government surveillance suggest that we can be watched, that we are being listened to at any moment, so thanks for that. In our commercial lives, everything we buy or even consider buying can be tracked from our purchases right down to our eye movements. Thanks for that. And soon, with the ability to remote monitor my heart data and vital signs, the cloud will be listening to my heartbeat, know all about my health, lots more. So here's Edward Snowden crowing, intelligently analyzing his role in all this, engaging in hyperbole and self-marketing. You decide. In an interview with the Washington Post, Edward Snowden recently told reporter Barton Gellman, quote, "For me, in terms of personal satisfaction, the mission's already accomplished. I already won. As soon as the journalists were able to work, everything that I'd been trying to do was validated. Because remember, I didn't want to change society. I wanted to give society a chance to determine if it should change itself." Headline there, privacy is over. Who do we thank for that? Probably not Edward Snowden. But perhaps, and maybe, our outmoded, naive expectation of privacy really does need a new look, a fundamentally different conversation. That's our mission today. Joel Brenner is a former NSA Inspector General and author of Glass Houses, Privacy, Secrecy, and Cyber Insecurity in a Transparent World. Joel, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Here in the studio with me is Susan Crawford, visiting professor at Harvard Law School, who served as President Obama's Special Assistant for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy. Susan, welcome.
Great to be here.
And also with us is Nita Farahani, who's a professor of law, genomics, and policy at Duke University. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with you, Professor. How much do you think our notion of privacy has changed the way we think about our private health data? And start with Edward Snowden or anywhere you want to begin.
So, it's interesting because I think health data is one area in which we have the greatest protection. And yet, even that protection is coming under challenge as we move into the electronic world. And that's whether you think about health records where we try to link them up between different electronic databases so that at any given time, hundreds of people have access to your electronic health information. Or if you think about the new wave of personal health trackers where there are millions of applications that people already have on their smartphones, devices that they carry around with them that are electronically transmitting information that don't get the same kind of protection as health information traditionally does, and that information is widely shared. So, I think even in the most protected area, there's a move away from privacy and toward sharing. And that move is actually a quite good one for consumer health because it enables us to have much greater access to information that could improve our lives.
So, Susan Crawford, if there's a control room, a situation room in the White House where instead of watching people's movements, all right, in terms of national security, they were actually monitoring the public health of Americans using some of the health data that Nita Farahani was talking about, that seems to me to be a positive sort of end of privacy moment. How do you see this? Privacy is fundamentally different today.
We're going through a data revolution that's even more intense than the initial launch of the commercial internet. With all the sensors embedded in products in our, in our streets and everything around us that are context aware, we can be tracked, but we can also be helpfully watched. So we're entering into an era when we worry now about oversight and checks on this kind of information collection. But there are lots of benefits to society that come from it.
That Susan Crawford is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. She also served as President Obama's Special Assistant for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy. We're talking about the death of privacy in America in 2013. We get to the national security guy last in this panel, and I'm wondering if the government is sort of late to this game on some level technologically, that the Googles of the world and the sort of cell phone networks of the world preceded it.
You know, the data doesn't divide up into categories so easily. We're talking about national security data or health data or other kinds of data. It's all data. And you can't pick and choose the parts of it that you want to be easily moved around and the parts that you don't want to be easily moved around and available. It's all moves around like comet dust. And whenever privacy comes in conflict with convenience, convenience wins hands down every time. So that we are finding this new world, even though it makes us uneasy, frankly, irresistible. The government's data, which is so troublesome now to so many people, is going to be relatively easy to regulate. The government's ability can be made transparent and can be regulated, whereas what we do with consumer data, I think, is going to be much harder to come to grips with. And yes, we are in a transparent world, whether we like it or not.
Former NSA Inspector Joel Brenner. Susan Crawford here in the studio is vigorously shaking her head. What do you have to say to that?
We're right that the same technology that enables the NSA snooping also enables extensive consumer surveillance. But the government can take your life and constrain your freedom. So we should keep our focus on real oversight of what's going on at the government level. And so far, those protections aren't in place.
But the irony here is that the government can also save your life in terms of its access to and ability to mobilize on the level of public health. Nita Farahani, isn't that one of the real ironies here? This data can be used to save as well as to arrest and incarcerate.
Yeah, it certainly can. And it isn't just the government, of course, who can have access to that data. It is also private companies who can have access to that data. So as people start to share their information much more broadly, like just a simple example, there are basic heart rate monitors, and there are now online EEG devices that enable people to measure brain waves. And for somebody who is an epileptic, it can actually predict before a person has an epileptic seizure that they're about to have an epileptic seizure. And that person may be willing to give monitoring information either over to their health insurance provider or over to a monitoring company, just like we have our alarm systems at our homes monitored. And by doing so, they can get an alert on their iPhone telling them, you know, hey, you need to slow down, you need to take your medication, you may be about to suffer from an epileptic attack. That's wonderful. You know, that's a terrific innovation that by giving simple, basic information about what's happening immediately about your health, you could prevent an insulin shock or an epileptic attack or even a heart attack that might occur. So there are real benefits to sharing information. And I think Joel's right. The convenience, especially if you have a health condition, overwhelms any desire for privacy in these types of situations.
Although if I hacked into such a system and realized that the pilot of the plane I was flying on was about to have an epileptic seizure, it could certainly be a destabilizing moment for all the passengers if I start screaming, right?
Not just an epileptic seizure. You know, there's a lot more that you can start to measure than just epilepsy. So there are a tremendous number of brain-based devices that are coming online. Some of them are invasive and implanted in the brain. Some of them are, you know, wearable gadgets that are part of the fitness revolution. Most of those transmit information via Bluetooth to iPhones, and most of them don't have much security yet. And so it's pretty easy, you know, much easier than even hacking into an iPhone is going to be hacking into somebody's brainwave device. And while right now the kind of information that we can glean from that is pretty limited, as neuroscience becomes better, that type of information will get even better. So I think it's right to be concerned. I'm not just concerned about government access of that information. I'm concerned about ensuring that people understand what kind of information private companies are accessing and what they could do with it. They may not be able to take your life, but they can certainly hike up premiums. They can certainly target you for particular advertisements. And there's a great convenience for that. But there's also some worry about the misinformation that could be gathered about you and misinformation that could be traded and sold about you.
As a sort of a tagline here, I'm wondering if the three of you could comment on something our listeners say repeatedly. And, you know, a lot of people are very, very nervous about all of this and express the same kind of anxieties and concerns that you've expressed. But there's a segment of our audience that also says, you know what, it's going to make people more honest. I don't have anything to hide. So go ahead. Listen in. It's going to make people more honest and above board. Joel?
Well, hypocrisy is harder to pull off in a transparent world. And that's definitely true. It's harder to hide things, whether it's personal health issues or marital affairs or bad behavior. It's harder to hide things, but it's also harder to hide things that are embarrassing and that traditionally we've felt are nobody else's business.
Susan Crawford, a more honest, unprivate world?
I think it's important to take the long view. If information is never forgotten, then someone can use something about your past in a way that might be very disruptive to your life. So that's why oversight is going to be essential.
Nita Farahani, you can have the last word.
I think it's true that oversight is important. My concern is really about squelching creativity, because if it's true that nothing is ever private, if it's true that there's no freedom for people to be able to have outlandish ideas, we have to be worried and ensure that we create a space for people to be creative and different in this transparent world.
Nita Farahani is professor of law, genomics, and policy at Duke University. Susan Crawford is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. And Joel Brenner is a former NSA inspector general and author of Glass Houses, Privacy, Secrecy, and Cyber Insecurity in a Transparent World. Thanks to the three of you.
Thanks so
much.
Thank
you.
Pleasure.
So it's the last Friday of 2013, a good year or a bad year? We've heard lots of stories from you over the past 2 weeks about that, but that's not really the question, is it? I mean, the big question is, are you peaking if it's a good year? Are you just getting started and the best years are ahead of you? Or this is it, best years behind me, downhill from here? That's a more profound question, right?
Hey, this is Bruce from Tallahassee, Florida. And yeah, the best years of my life are behind me, and I say that because I've accomplished more in my life than I ever dreamed of, and done more and been to more places, really, than I ever expected, and now I'm going to ease into a quiet and peaceful retirement, so I think the coming years won't be nearly as meaningful as what has happened before.
So I'll go visit Bruce, or one of you in Louisville, Kentucky. My best years are way behind me. The only good thing to be said about getting old is that it's better than the alternative. But here's an alternative from one of you reaching a milestone.
Hi, this is Kevin Sutton from Dallas, Texas. I certainly believe that the best years of my life are to come. I'm turning 50 next February, and in this past year, I chose to give up alcohol. I think that's been the best decision of my life. It's completely turned everything in my world around to a positive way. So my next decade is going to be the decade of joy and success.
Go, Kev. Best years in front or behind? Anybody? Anybody?
My name is Julie. I'm calling from Omaha, Nebraska. And in response to your question about the best years being ahead or behind me, as I'm getting close to 50, I'm struggling a lot with this question, and I've spent a lot of years and months contemplating it. I've come to the conclusion that whether the best is truly yet to come is pretty much up to me. But the next question is, how do I make the years ahead of me better than the years behind?
Thanks, Julie. Later this hour, philosophy professor Todd May will explore this question. Share your story about what you consider your best years. Are they in front or behind you at 8778-MY-TAKE? This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.